The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So welcome back to our last class. And at dinner today, I told my wife that I was going to come down here to teach the last introductory class, and she said to me, "What do you tell them to do when you're meditating and nothing's happening?" She thought that was a good question, important question, because sometimes in meditation you sit and nothing happens. You're sitting there and nothing's happening. So I said that more or less that something is happening. With mindfulness, we pay attention to what's happening. And when nothing's happening, that's what's happening. And so then we pay attention to what it feels like to have nothing happen. Bring mindfulness and note that nothing's happening. And remember, we have to be patient. But nothing happening is a very interesting situation to be in, because often there's a lot of beliefs and ideas and judgments about what should be happening, get involved in there with that. Usually it comes along with some idea for example, one idea is that something is supposed to be happening. And that could be, a fine idea, but there can be all kinds of baggage that goes along with something's happening. I'm supposed to be a successful meditator, I'm supposed to be in states of bliss, I'm supposed to be interesting, I'm supposed to be wonderful, or whatever. And all these expectations about what the experience is supposed to be like and what you're supposed to be like in that having that experience. And a lot of that can represent a lot of attachment, a lot of things we're clinging to. And sometimes it's really valuable to sit in meditation when so-called nothing's happening, because then we get to look at all that and begin perhaps relaxing all the expectations and demands and desires and self-identities that goes into being the one who's successful, the one who's trying to make something happen. So we pay attention to what it's like and, what's happening, what's like if nothing's happening. Why isn't it okay for nothing to be, that nothing's happening? That's what I told my wife at dinner, and she was satisfied. So I don't know if you're satisfied, but again, as I've kept saying here, the main thing we're doing in mindfulness practice is paying attention to what is, and so whatever it might be, the default is, what is that? What is this? What's going on here? Let's be present for it, as opposed to let's make it go away, let's change it, let's make it into something better. There's all kinds of change will happen. It's guaranteed that if you sit and meditate, things will change. If you say to right now nothing's happening, either you're not looking very carefully, or you just need to wait because it'll change. And so it's your job as a meditator doing this practice here is just to watch, see, be present. It's a very powerful thing to do because it takes the momentum out of all the neurotic ways in which we're always changing things and not accepting things and resisting things. And, so much of our life is built on this movement of non-acceptance, of over-acceptance, clinging, holding on, resisting, all this stuff. So just to stop all that game, it takes the cornerstone out from underneath much of the way in which people's psychological structure is even built. So it's a very powerful thing to do. But also, mindfulness practice is a way of seeing more clearly what is here and being able to see through some of the overlay of interpretations that we put on our life so we can see more clearly and not see through this filter of ideas. And that ability to see clearly and to go through the filters is often called in Buddhism wisdom. And so we're cultivating wisdom, deeper understanding, insight into our experience. The word insight, which is our meditation center is named after, is a translation of the word vipassana, the Buddhist word, that means to see clearly, or to have insight. And this is an insight practice. And what makes mindfulness practice insight is when the mindfulness is clear enough, when the mind we can see clearly enough, that we begin seeing something about our life that we didn't see before. And in Buddhism, it's not seeing something like particular to you. Oh, the reason why you know, the reason why I, you know, why I, you know, always open the newspaper at, you know, the classified ads first, is because when I was a kid, that's the only part of the newspaper I was allowed to read. I don't know. It's making something up, right? So, oh, that's why it works that way. Now I see. Now I understand. This is why. Well, that wouldn't be considered, that's an insight to understand why you do certain things. But in Buddhism, it's not considered to be Buddhist insight. Buddhist insight is to see something, it's not Buddhist per se, but to see something which is universal, something that's true for all of us. So it's not particular to me in my particular situation. So it's not psychological and or biographical in that sense. And the deeper work of practice, the deeper Buddhist practice, the deeper possibilities of freedom come a lot from seeing these deeper insights. And there's a variety of them that come from when the mindfulness is strong enough to see what's here. So I want to give an example that, of how the mindfulness practice can help us to cut through some of the overlays of ideas that we have on experience, the concepts, allow us to see more deeply into what's going on here, and perhaps give you a sense of how seeing more deeply into what's more universal can be freeing, can be very satisfying and meaningful. And it entails using some flowers. And so if I hold up this flower here, hopefully you can all see this flower. So when I hold up one flower like this, you see the flower, hopefully. I know it's a little bit small, but... And you see the flowerness of the flower. You see it as it is in and of itself. You see the flower in and of itself. Just a flower. Beautiful flower. And in Buddhism, sometimes we refer to this as the suchness of the flower. The flower is such, just the suchness of it. It can't be described, because it's something indescribable about a flower, the fullness or the of something like this. We'll just call it the suchness. So that's nice. But now, we could do something interesting, and that is, I could hold up this other flower next to the first flower. And now we can say something, and it's really, well, it's really small, so hopefully you can see it. But it's now we can say something we couldn't say before. We can say, this is the big flower, and this is the small flower. And my left hand is the big flower, the right hand is the small flower. You see that? Okay, that's reasonable. Big deal. But now watch this. This is magic, right? You can see how the sleight of hand works. This is the big one, right? Big flower, small flower. Now, which is this big flower? The flower that was the big one is no longer the big one. Now, with this big rose in my right hand, the flower in my left hand is now the small flower. Small and big do not reside in the suchness of anything. In something in and of itself is not either big or small, tall or short, but rather it has those qualities because of how the comparative mind compares it to other things. It belongs to the world of concepts, ideas, comparisons. A lot of human suffering arises out of that world of comparative thinking. So, for example, we compare ourselves to someone else. I'm not as tall as that person. Or I'm not as short, or as small, or as big, or as smart, or as kind, or as resilient, or something. We have all these ideas. And then once we start making those ideas, we depart from the immediacy of how we actually are in our suchness, how we are in and of ourselves. But we're comparing ourselves to an idea, in this case maybe compared to an idea of how someone else is, and then measuring ourselves according to that and saying, I should be different, as opposed to just being there in our own suchness, as we are. So, for example, if I told you that I'm a lousy basketball player, you should appropriately come back and say, compare to what? Compare to who? And if I say, who's a great basketball player these days? Kobe Bryant? Is that his name? What he's called? Some of you don't know. I hardly know. There was a time Michael Jordan used to be great, right? Well, compared to Michael Jordan, you know, I'm a lousy player. Well, if I said that, I mean, what are you going to, you're going to feel I'm kind of ridiculous to compare myself to one of the greatest basketball players ever. But if I say, you know, lousy compared to what? You know, and I say, well, compared to that 8-year-old boy down the street. Well, so what I'm trying to say in my clumsy way is that we can compare ourselves. And who do you choose to compare yourself to? What do you do the comparisons with? And all kinds of different issues. So as we sit and meditate, there also we can notice if we're operating through the filter of comparative thinking, concepts. And we can do that and we can have insight, small insights. We can say, oh yeah, I'm taller than he is. Oh, I have longer hair than she does. I mean, that you can. That's a fair thing to observe and notice. But then we add value to that. And with that added value, then we sometimes will suffer or feel great. So I give you an example. When I was 17, I was 13. It was summer of 1967, and some of you maybe weren't old enough, but remember that time. But that summer I went and lived in Italy after spending a year in California, and it was kind of the brink of the beginning of the hippie time and long hair and all that. And so I went to this small provincial city in Italy, and I had the longest hair of anyone there, any boy there, and I had the only blue jeans in town. So I was cool. And I felt a certain energy and aliveness and coolness. Wow, you know, this is great. I'm so hip, whatever. And then after the end of the summer of 67, I flew back to California. And unbeknownst to me, a lot happened in California in the summer of 67. So I came back to school, and my hair was not the longest hair of any boy in school anymore. And my blue jeans, I just had ordinary blue jeans. And my classmates had figured out you take your blue jeans and you wash them in the washing machine 100 times, put bleach in, you cut them up, you put them out in the road and the cars would drive over them, and then you'd sew them up. And I just had blue jeans. So I would sit, you know, compare. So I felt I came back. All I did was I crossed the Atlantic and came back to a new setting. And now I was comparing myself to different people. And now I hadn't changed, you know, hardly grew, you know, in that 12-hour flight, my hair hardly grew. You know, but now I was comparing myself, and now I felt deflated. With one comparison, I felt inflated, and the other comparison, I felt deflated, even though I hadn't changed. So when we sit and meditate, the idea is to see how this operates, and learn how to put this aside, and begin to see ourselves in our suchness, to be present for ourselves as we are here this moment, without an overlay of interpretations, judgments, comparisons. And for some people, this is a phenomenally radical thing to do, to have an experience of oneself where we don't see ourselves through comparisons, through shoulds, shouldn'ts. It just, this is how it is. So this would be kind of an insight in Buddhism. This would be a connection to something deeper that mindfulness can provide you. Mindfulness can help show you how you see your experience through these ideas, how ideas work, and then you can learn to let go of them and see yourself or have an experience of yourself that's much more basic and immediate. And that much more basic and immediate way of experiencing yourself is much more satisfying. I won't do it now, but sometimes I've done a little guided meditation with people where I've had them think about some part of their body that they feel really bad about. And, you know, most people, turns out, have some part of their body that's something, you know, it's too big, too small, too this, too that, whatever. And then ask them to, you know, and then feel a suffering of that. Like I would sit, when I was 13, I would sit in the California classroom trying to pull my hair, feeling bad, trying to make it grow faster, whatever. So, and then switch the guidance and say, okay, now drop all that ideas, and now take that body part of yours, and from the inside of your body, just feel that body part, that part of your body, in and of itself, how it is. And mostly when people come back, they say, oh, but I drop all the ideas, and just experience the suchness of that, it's actually no problem. It actually feels good. It's actually nice. Like when I was down around 13, 14, I used to worry a lot in school that I had receding hairline. I have a little bit of high forehead. And I can tell you how many times I would sit in class measuring. You know, I had this I put my finger in the corner on the top of my nose and kind of measure and get a sense and compare day to day. Does it change? What a waste of time. And my forehead was quite happy. My forehead didn't, you know, if I allowed my body to experience the forehead in and of itself, the forehead didn't care how the hairline, what it was like. So in so many ways, to learn to drop the thoughts, the comparisons, the shoulds, provides us with access to a deeper place of satisfaction, deeper place of being alive, that's much more meaningful than what often happens if we're working through the filter of ideas and shoulds. So that's a little example of how the mindfulness leads to kind of insight and a deeper understanding to wisdom. And there's a variety of different kinds of wisdoms like this that can come when the practice settles down and we get we're able to really kind of start connecting to our experience moment by moment. It takes a while to do that. And one of the big things that everybody has to work with is the amazing strength of the thinking mind, the mind that wants to go into the future and the past and think about things. And so we need a lot of wisdom about how to include the very things that are distracting us and making it part of the practice itself. So as I've said in this class, we don't think there's any distractions when we do mindfulness practice. It's just something else to notice. So the very forces that take us away from the present moment are not to be resisted or pushed away or denied, but rather in a certain way we turn towards them and recognize them and see them. And when we see them mindfully, then they're not distractions anymore. And then we just see them as they are in the suchness of that. We don't have to feel like it should be different. I'm supposed to have you don't have to think. I'm supposed to have a silent mind and not think. What you're supposed to do is be mindful of thinking. Be mindful of the suchness of thinking. A little exercise I've done some occasionally is imagined that I was a Martian naturalist, a naturalist from Mars, and somehow I was transported in my little spaceship right into Gil Fronsdal's brain, into my mind. And it was just fascinating. You know, naturalist, you know, what is this? What's the thinking? This person thinks, and this is what thinking is like. And you kind of just really be present for the experience in and of itself as opposed to all the shoulds that we overlay on top of it. That makes sense? So, you want to try sitting in your suchness? So, it's always useful to take a few moments to help yourself arrive here, to settle into here, perhaps by swaying your body back and forth or sideways, because the body is a really important support for being present and being mindful. Feeling the contact of your body against your chair, your cushion, the floor. Gently closing your eyes. Sometimes it's helpful in the beginning of a meditation session to spend a minute or two seeing what you can do to put yourself at ease. So to put yourself at ease in your body. Be at ease physically. And if there are discomforts in the body, tensions, then be easy with that. And be easy in your mind. Be at ease, ease up. And if you can, set yourself at ease in your heart. If there are feelings which are difficult, see if you can be easy with that. And then taking a couple of three deep, slow breaths, connecting to your body from the inside. As you exhale, relaxing. Letting your breath return to normal. And it can also be useful at the beginning of a sitting to spend just a brief time noticing if there's any tension in your body that you could easily relax or soften. Sometimes it can be the muscles of the face. Sometimes the shoulders can be relaxed, or the shoulder blades. And letting the belly become soft. And then as if it's at the center of many concentric circles, we connect the attention to our breathing, letting breathing be the center. Feeling your breathing, how the body breathes. Allowing the experience of breathing to help pull you into the present, gather you into the present moment experience here. The idea is to be mindful, which means to know or to acknowledge what is happening. So when the mind wanders off in thought, no need to make that a problem. It's the suchness of a thought. Your job is simply to acknowledge it, to recognize your mind is thinking. And then if it's easy enough to let go of it, let go and come back to your breathing. Anything that happens that pulls your attention away from the breathing, allow yourself to know or experience the suchness of that. Car driving by, discomfort or comfort in your body, feelings, emotions. Take it in your mindfulness and your awareness. Recognize it in a very simple way. Whatever calls your attention away from the breathing, that becomes the meditation. And when it's no longer compelling, then go back again to your breathing. Letting the breathing be the place of center, where you center yourself. In a very easy, relaxed way. Also notice if there are overlays of ideas and shoulds and shouldn'ts, expectations, comparisons that keep you from the simplicity of your experience now. The suchness of who we are, the simplicity of being, suchness of anything, can only be experienced in the present moment. It only exists here and now. then to end this sitting, you can take a couple of deep breaths, and when you're ready, you can open your eyes. So in these 6 weeks, I've provided you with the basic instructions for mindfulness meditation, and with the idea that we're learning to bring mindfulness to all aspects of our life. There's nothing which is outside or be excluded, and we don't have to be at war with anything or resist anything, and we also don't have to cling to anything. We just have to note what's going on. And so hopefully you can at least get a sense, at least kind of maybe a theoretical sense, that everything in our human experience is something we bring mindfulness to. Nothing's outside. And then it's a matter of training, practicing, and developing that capacity to do that. And it takes time. It takes patience. It takes doing it. If you don't do it, you're not going to get good at it. And I have a son who feels that if he's not good at something, you know, right away, then he's not good, doesn't want to do it at all. And if I try to explain to him, well, you know, a lot of things in life you have to practice, and then you can get good at it. It somehow doesn't compute in his mind. It's not, that logic doesn't work, and he expects to be either good at it or you don't do it at all. But anyway, the practice, meditation like this, something that you practice. And what's quite remarkable is how much development there is that just simply happens because you keep showing up, keep doing it. And just slowly, it's like slowly things gather together, things settle down, the mind gets stronger. But so once you have the basic instructions, the question is how to continue, how to develop the practice further. And it's furthered by continuity of practice, doing it regularly and ongoingly. If you want to boil water and you turn the kettle on for 15 seconds, you turn it off and go do something else, come back, you know, 10 minutes later and turn it on for a little while longer, and maybe this time it's 20 seconds and you turn it off and go do something else, the water's never going to boil. You have to keep the flame going in order for it to boil. So the same thing with meditation practice. If you, I mean, it's always good to meditate, but if you really want to get get it going, develop it, if you meditate one day and then say, well, I'll take a vacation for 6 months, and just, you know, when the conditions are right, I'll meditate again, then it's not going to develop and grow. One of the best attitudes or approaches to meditation, if you want to develop it, is to do it every day regardless of whether you want to or not. And many people are very accustomed to, in one way or the other, living according to their preferences. And it's actually a very radical thing to have something you do that does not belong to your preferences. So there are days when you might prefer to meditate. Since you're committed every day, you do it anyway. There are days when you don't want to meditate. It's the last thing you want to do, but you're committed, so you do it anyway. And to operate outside your preferences allows you to meet yourself in the full range of who you are, to really see yourself, to be present. There's something very wonderful, I think, about the qualitative ability to meet oneself, know oneself, experience oneself, that can happen in meditation. That's richer than almost any other place in life. And so what we want to do is to have the full range of who we are coming through this field of awareness. And so by sitting outside of your preferences, then whether you want to or not, then you get to see the wide range. Once you start having your preferences come into play, then you're going to only see part of who you are. Some people only meditate when they feel good. Some people only meditate when they feel lousy. And you don't get the full range. So the continuity is very important. Another thing that's very helpful for allowing this mindfulness practice to develop and mature is to couple it with concentration. mindfulness and concentration are partners. And this class I've been teaching you about mindfulness, but classically in Buddhism you would combine mindfulness with concentration, these two qualities of the mind. And the difference is could be explained in analogy. It's one thing to have a camera that you take pictures with. It's another thing to put the camera on a tripod to take a picture. If you are trying to take a picture of something really, really far away, and you're trying to hold it in your hand, the camera, maybe it's going to be wobbly, and you won't get a clear picture. But if you put it in a tripod, then you have stability that gives you clarity. So the same thing with the mind. If the mind is not stable, then the mind's not going to see very clearly. And once you, the function of concentration is to stabilize the mind. So you're really settled and calm and grounded here to be able to see. The mind that's not concentrated, you can be mindful, but it's really hard to be mindful in some deep, ongoing way if the mind is jumping around a lot. And so one of the functions of concentration is to help the mind settle down, calm down, so it's not jumping around, and so we can actually see more clearly. Now, there's various ways of developing concentration, bring concentration in as a partner to mindfulness. One is what I just mentioned, is continuity. Just if you keep doing the mindfulness regularly, just the regularity of practice brings into it concentration with time. It follows in the wake of mindfulness. Another way is to practice in such a way that specifically is cultivating concentration. And one way to do that, if you feel like the mind is really unstable, is to just stay with the first week's instructions for a while, which is just stay with the breath. The breath works as a wonderful, for most people, a very effective focus for concentration. And just keep it really simple. It could be that doing the full range of the instructions that I gave you is maybe too complicated if the mind is agitated and jumping around. And it's actually easier for the mind to settle and get concentrated if you keep it really simple, just the breath. Come back to the breath, be with the breath. And once the mind has some concentration or some stability or some calm, then perhaps you can open the attention up and be able to take in, be mindful of greater range of what your experience is. In Buddhism, concentration and mindfulness, but concentration in particular, that stability of mind, is greatly supported by being ethical, living an ethical life. And in Buddhism, we emphasize not just ordinary ethics. I'm sure all of you are ordinarily ethical. None of you have robbed banks recently, probably. But to actually be really kind of really careful that you live in an ethical way, and not because you're supposed to be, because Buddha is moralistic. It just happens to be, just coincidence. For some reason, it's a coincidence that if you live really ethically, you're much more likely to have a stable mind, a calm mind. And if you live unethically, it just happens to be, just the way it seems to work, that your mind's going to be much more likely to be agitated. And so often in Buddhism, we emphasize this pragmatic value of the ethics. It just helps you if you want to meditate to live that way. And so Buddhists will spend a lot of care on the ethics of how they speak, their behavior in many different ways. The other thing that in our tradition that we put emphasis on for developing that concentration that supports the mindfulness and also for developing mindfulness further is meditation retreats. And we're kind of like a big, our particular tradition of Buddhism is really big on retreats. And that is not for everybody, it's not necessary to do it, but we just happen to be big on it. And I find a lot of value in it. And so retreats are times or extended periods of time that are devoted to living quietly, simply, so that you have the optimal conditions for practicing a lot of meditation. So, for example, here on Wednesday mornings, we have what's called a half-day retreat from 9:30 to 12:15. And so there's a period where it's basically silent. And during that silent time, there's a couple of meditation sessions and some walking meditation and that you do in a short talk. And so that gives you an extended period of time to get into it. And there's something happens when you give an extended period of time, it allows the mind, the heart, the body to settle and kind of get absorbed in the activity in a way that you can't if you just do it for 20 minutes. 20 minutes is great, but you can't immerse, kind of like immersion into that world. And so you have much more continuity and development that can happen. We have one-day retreats here. And then here at IMC, we also put on longer retreats, which we call residential retreats, because you'd go and be in residence someplace for a couple of days or a week or 2 weeks. In the month of March, I go to teach 30-day residential retreat. So the people who come will be coming to be there for 30 days in silence. Basically, it's mostly in silence. There's a little bit of conversation with the teachers. You have interviews with the teachers, but a little minimal conversation about everyone has a little job they do to mix, you know, wash dishes or something. So some talking about that, but it's really a silent time. And in that silence, the silence is a great field for heightening awareness. And so, and then there's a chance to do a lot of meditation. Much of the day is spent doing meditation. And it's one of the people who really get into this find some of the most beautiful experiences they can have. I would say for me that some of the most profound, the most profound and the most beautiful and experiences and the most happy times of my life have been when I've been on long retreats. It's just, I don't know, it seems maybe strange, but to say that to people not accustomed to it, but it was really a really profound thing, and I'm very, very grateful for what I was able to do and practice and realize and how the spiritual life grows and develops in that kind of laboratory or that kind of specialized environment of retreats. So we retreat, so it's a big thing. So that's one way of kind of having this continuity, much more continuity, develop concentration. Some people find that it really jumpstarts a meditation practice. If you go on retreat, people often come back with much more engagement in the practice, much more depth to it, much more kind of momentum going into it. Sometimes people have trouble kind of keeping on regular practice going, and they go on retreat, and that kind of just plugs them into it. So some of you might be interested in that at some point. If you get into the practice and do it for a while, you might think of doing a retreat. The other way of cultivating, developing the practice, both strengthening mindfulness, and so it becomes a stronger muscle, but also to help support this greater stability as we practice, is to bring the practice off the cushion, off your meditation time, into your daily life, and to begin practicing mindfulness in all your activities. So mindfulness is not just something you do in meditation, but something you can do in everywhere. And I remember the wonderful time for me. I'd been meditating regularly for about 2 years and was getting into it, really enjoyed it a lot. And then it kind of dawned on me that my mind that I had in meditation was the same mind I had in daily life. And the sense of integrity that I experienced and subtleness I felt in meditation, why should it only be in meditation? Why not kind of begin exploring and developing that part of me in daily life as well? And so then I got interested in bringing mindfulness to my daily life and to notice more carefully what goes on in my daily life when I'm talking to people. It's really hard to be mindful when you're talking. It takes a lot of care because we get pulled into the conversation and the feelings and everything. But it's really one of the most powerful places to be mindful because it's so consequential. And there's so much of us behind the scenes, our emotions, our feelings, our values, our reactions, that come into play when we're talking and listening. And so to begin cultivating ability to be present and listening, be present and know what's happening as we talk, as opposed to being lost in the conversation. When I was a young meditator, I went and talked to a Zen teacher, and I was very enthusiastic about something, and I was telling him enthusiastically about something, and he kind of paused for a moment. He looked at me and he said, "Talking to you is like talking to a drug addict." And I think the reason is that caught my attention. And I wasn't a drug addict, but I was so absorbed, addicted, kind of lost in my world of what I was trying to say. And you can look sometimes at other people's eyes when they're telling you something and find out, are they really present for you or present what's going on? Are they kind of lost in the world of what they're trying to say? Anyway, there's a lot to bring mindfulness there. It's fascinating to notice what goes on there. it's difficult there, so there are a lot of more simpler ways to do it in daily life, to notice, start paying more attention to what happens for you in ordinary activities. It could be as simple as when you go from, when you park your car and you have to walk someplace, like maybe go to walk into your place of work, to spend a few moments there walking mindfully. Just walk to that place mindfully as opposed to the other things you can do. You can worry about the work or plan or do whatever. But practice really being mindful and present for this moment's experience as you walk into your office or your store or whatever. Or if you're standing in the market waiting for the checkout clerk to be ready for you, you could look at the National Enquirer. That's one option. And get educated. Or you could judge everybody else for what they're buying. Or you could do all kinds of things you could do. Be impatient. Or you could step back from being involved in all these kinds of ways the mind usually gets involved and be mindful. Notice what's going on here. What's happening here for you? And you might learn a lot. It might be very helpful. And by the time you're ready to be with a clerk, you have much more presence. You're ready, more, maybe a little calmer, and can have a more deeper connection. I think one of the interesting ways of practicing daily life is over a period of weeks, choose one activity for each week that you're going to try to do mindfully. So it could be, for example, washing your dishes. So this first week, you're going to wash dishes mindfully. Another week, it's going to be, perhaps it's going to be folding your clothes after you do your laundry. And to really be there for that experience in a full, kind of clear way, not to get it over with, not do it as quickly as you can, but to really kind of center yourself and ground yourself and really be mindful of what that whole experience is like, as if you have all the time in the world to really be there and feel it and experience it. It could be driving. The world would be a lot better place if there were more mindful drivers. And so practice mindfulness for a week when you drive, which means you turn off the radio and turn off your cell phones and just be present for driving. It's a lot easier to be mindful when you drive if you keep both hands on the steering wheel. It just actually, that you're more engaged in the process, and so it's easier, that translates back to being more present for the experience. So some people like to kind of choose different activities, and then over time, it leaves a kind of remnant in us that when we come back to that activity in the future, we're not necessarily thinking we're going to be mindful, but we have a taste of what it's like, and we're reminded, and it's easier then to be mindful. It's pretty hard to say, I'm going to be mindful for the rest of my, from now on, all I'm going to do is be mindful. It's a setup for failure, right? But you can, if you do it in small chunks, in small pieces, then you can build to momentum. It's like training yourself. Some people like to have little cues that they use. So little reminders called mindfulness reminders. One that I like sometimes I've used is the telephone ringing. Because I've noticed that I have this phenomenon in me. I don't know where it comes from. But there's this imperative inside of me, desperate imperative, that I have to answer the telephone at the fewest possible rings. Now, no, most people don't hang up after three rings. Most people are patient and will go longer. So rather than grabbing for the phone right away, I'll kind of pause. I'll use that ringing as a time to check in with myself, take a couple of breaths, just find out where I am at. And then because I'm more present and know where I'm at, then when I answer the phone, that translates to being more present for that person as well. In the Zen monasteries I trained in, there was a custom that when you go into the meditation hall, there was a choreographed way you had to walk into the hall. And that was that you had to always step through the threshold into the meditation hall with a foot that was closest to the door frame. So sometimes they have big doors. So whatever part of your body that was closest to the, so if your right side of the body was closest to the door frame, your right foot would go over first. So you had to, you couldn't just kind of casually go into the meditation hall. You had to always notice where you were and what foot and all that. And so it was a training to be mindful. And I saw a lot about myself. I saw sometimes I was impatient and hurried to get there, sometimes reluctant, sometimes spaced out. And that was a reminder. I called the mindfulness doors. So that was interesting. So then I used that for a period of time the rest of my life. Whenever I walked through a door frame, I would not necessarily be concerned which door, foot went over the door or through the door. But I would use that as a time to notice, be mindful, what's going on here? And then often I find I wasn't paying attention, I was lost in thought. And so, oh, what's happening here? And I always thought that was very significant because a door marks going into a new space. And so it's good to be mindful of a new space. So to cultivate mindfulness in daily life, it can be very, very effective and actually very powerful. I'll give you the classic example in our tradition that we use for this, how powerful it can be, is one of the great teachers in West American teachers in our tradition is a woman named Kamala Masters. And she was a single mom raising four kids. And she got interested in meditation. And somehow or other, she was able to go on a meditation retreat with an Indian mindfulness teacher from India. And somehow at the end of the retreat, she invited him to come and stay in her house with her. Now, it was a little different. He gave, at the end of the retreat, he said, oh, it's really important to practice mindfulness in daily life. And it's really important to meditate regularly. And she said to him, you know, I can't meditate regularly. I can't have a meditation practice. I have four kids to get to school, take care of, I have to work, and lunch has to be made, and all this stuff. And there's no time for me to meditate. I can't do it. And so somehow or other, she invited him to stay with her for a while. And he, I think he was kind of convinced to show her that she could. And he was there with her for some days, and then he said, you're right. and so he said, okay, I'll teach you what you do instead. And he shadowed her, and when she washed dishes, he showed her how to wash dishes mindfully and did the laundry mindfully. And then there was a hallway in the house, and you know, all the rooms were kind of connected by this hallway. And so she was always going through this hallway. And he told her, that hallway is your meditation hall. Whenever you step into that hallway to walk to another room, be mindful of yourself walking through the hallway. So she did this, and she really had a lot of confidence in this practice and doing this and a lot of devotion. She really put herself into it. I don't know for how many years, but a good number of years. She couldn't go on retreat, she couldn't go on retreat. At some point, her kids were old enough. And she had developed so much momentum in the mindfulness that when she finally was able to go on retreat, she was so mindful and so concentrated, she matured in her practice faster than almost anybody. It was really remarkable. So so it's quite powerful and quite significant. And the more mindful you are in daily life, the more it supports mindfulness in meditation. The stronger mindfulness is in meditation, the more it supports mindfulness in daily life. They work really well together. I've known some people who've to get these little post-it dots, kind of dots, and they put it on different things in their house or in their office, like on the light switches or the telephone, different places. And every time they see that dot, be mindful. Be mindful. Know what's going on. I've never done that. But So these are the two primary ways of developing the practice further. One is to couple it with concentration, often done best on retreats. That's a very significant way of doing it. And the other is to practice in daily life. And again, what's beautiful, I think, about doing in daily life, it's another reminder that the full range of our human experience can be included in the field of awareness. As we do this practice and we bring more and more mindfulness, more awareness to all the different aspects of our life, more and more awareness of what's going on, and one of the beautiful things that we discover at some point is the awareness itself that knows is one of the most precious resources, treasures that we have. That there's something very powerful about awareness. Awareness we have is often invisible to us. We use it all the time, but we're so caught up and involved in our life and our concerns that we're not aware that we're aware. But once the mindfulness is strong enough that awareness stands out in the highlight, it becomes, you know, it feels like, I don't know what it feels like, what comes to mind is, it feels like if you've been really dirty for a long time, you take a wonderful shower and you come out of the shower so clean and kind of fresh feeling. And that freshness and aliveness of being clean stands out in the highlight. When the awareness becomes really strong, it stands out in that kind of freshness in a beautiful way. So, I've talked a lot. So now it's your turn for questions. Anything you want to say or ask?
Just more informational for me. This is my first night in here. So is there a place online where I can learn more about what you mean exactly by mindfulness?
Mm-hmm. This intro class that I taught, this is the sixth week, is online. So you can actually listen to all 6 weeks on our website. So that's a good way of doing it. And then the other thing is we do have, I think every Monday night and Thursday evening, right? We have intro classes. We get all this in 45 minutes or an hour. So, you know, some senior practitioner here at IMC will come and give you a short introduction to all this. And so that's one way to do it as well.
I had a really positive experience this afternoon. I had to go to the dentist, which is really not a fun thing for me. And I tried to think of it in terms of just, this is just 1 hour, make it what it is, just 1 hour. It ended up 2 hours. And I had this experience which has not happened at the dentist before, which is somehow my mind was able to focus on my breathing. Not for long, but it happened a couple of times during that period of 2 hours. And it was very surprising to me. It was very exciting. Something new, instead of feeling tortured.
And a victim who just is helpless.
Yeah.
It gives you some way to help yourself.
Right, right. So I just felt excited about that.
Beautiful.
So I'm intrigued by your comment that if we were to try to be mindful all of the time, that's a recipe for failure. What gets used up? What would be the problem with trying to do that? Why isn't that the goal?
It's a nice thing to be mindful. And we certainly encourage people to develop more and more mindfulness throughout the day. For people who are beginners to all this, it's a recipe for disaster because the mind is so strong. And we get pulled into our concerns, preoccupations, you know, very quickly and easily. So once you get stronger at this, it becomes easier and easier, and you can be mindful more of the time. But that statement was meant more for people who are new at this. But the second part of your question, I think, has to do with, should we be mindful all the time? And the goal of Buddhism is not to be mindful all the time. The goal of Buddhism is to be free of your suffering. And cultivating mindfulness, and we say sometimes, you want to cultivate enough mindfulness to do the work of freeing yourself from suffering. You don't necessarily have to cultivate mindfulness or awareness to the nth degree, to the maximum possible degree in which people can be mindful. Just enough to do the work. Make sense?
Yeah, I'd heard somewhere about concept of responding versus reacting in the context of mindfulness. That I don't really understand what that means. Is there a way to summarize that?
Yeah, it's a great topic. To react is to act impulsively based on our habits and reactive feelings. To respond is to in a sense kind of pause and be aware of what's going on, be aware of the situation. Be aware of ourselves and our reactions, the feelings come up, but not act on any of it. And then take it all in. And then having taken it all in, be able to have to choose what we think is the wisest or best response. When people use this dichotomy, reactions mean, when you're reaction, there's no choice. We didn't choose to react, it just, you know, there it is. A response involves a choice, because we had enough space in the mind, or enough pause, or objectivity, or something to.
So it would just be a couple of seconds, even to do that.
It could be almost instantaneous. Yeah.
So I feel kind of like that mom who said she really doesn't have time, and I'm trying to figure out what is a good way to do some kind of abridged version of practice, so that it's realistic. Uh-huh. And the other struggle is that I find it so much easier when you're leading us through this than on my own. So I was thinking, download some kind of podcast of your voice or something to do for like 5 minutes a day. But what do you suggest?
Anything you think, anything that's helpful for you. So as long as you feel it's helpful, by all means, you could do that. Listen to a guided meditation and all that. You want to be a little bit careful you don't become dependent on it. You want to use it to kind of get you started and get it connected and maybe help you if you're really frazzled. But the idea is eventually, it's really important to remember that in the back of your mind, the idea is to develop the inner strength that you can do it on your own and not rely on something. That's really when it begins taking hold and become meaningful. But by all means, if it's helpful in the life you're living. Some people need to spend some serious time reflecting on their life. And sometimes we need behavioral change more than we need meditation. Change how we're living our life. And so sometimes it's really worthwhile to spend some time reflecting. What are my priorities? All the things I'm doing? And do I really need to do them all? Do I need, am I overcommitted? Some people are overcommitted with a lot of good things. It's hard to let go of them because they seem good and right. But are we really sane? Are we really living a healthy life? And so sometimes, I know some people who've actually decided to cut back on certain things so they can meditate, even though those are good things, they were good things to do. Some people have no choice. There are people who have suddenly have a health condition, and they realize, wow, I can't live the way I was living anymore. I have to change my life and kind of live in a more settled, unstressful way. And so they let go of things and then they maybe start meditating. The other thing is to do it in small chunks. And so it might be very helpful, like for this Kamala Masters, you might consider your daily life and figure out where you can do it in small little pieces. And there's probably, you'll find, there's lots of times in daily life that are waiting times. You're waiting for a red light to turn green. You're waiting for in a line to get to the clerk or something. All these times, meditate. When you go to the toilet, is it the point of going to the toilet to get over peeing as quickly as you can and out of there? Is that the whole point? Or could you kind of just sit in the toilet for an extra minute and just breathe and be present? And so you can sprinkle in throughout your day little moments, little minutes here and there, and the cumulative effect can be quite meaningful.
I think I have an answer to my question, but I'm not sure if it is correct. And regardless, I'd like your view on it. The question is, it seems to me like the more I practice mindfulness, whether it is in daily life, activities, or sitting, the more mindless I become. My own investigation of the matter, my own answer to it, my guess as to why that is that it seems like the more mindfulness I practice, the more it feeds on my being a sensitive person.
Sensitive?
I'm generally a sensitive person. And I think when I practice mindfulness, it feeds on that. It makes that sensitivity in me stronger, more, what you call it, more tuned, I guess. Mm-hmm. as a result of that increased sensitivity, there is more agitation, and as a result of the agitation, there is more mindlessness. So practice of mindfulness ends up being mindlessness.
Could be.
And even though I am aware of this, if that is the case, I mean, which seems to be, at least based on my own investigation kind of into it, I don't know what to do, because on one hand, mindfulness is supposed to be a good thing. On the other hand, I guess maybe if the sensitivity is the culprit here, what's your suggestion on that? What to do about...
I have two suggestions for you. And one is, you need to become wise about your sensitivity. You have to study it and to see how it works. What happens to you when impressions come into that sensitivity? How do you react to it? How does it, you know, what do you pick up? What are your beliefs and ideas and feelings? And how are you with that? Because if you're troubled by that hypersensitivity, is it really a clean sensory experience? Or are there all kinds of ideas, values, sense of personal identity, judgments, comparisons that come into play as well? So one thing to do is you need to study that and study how you are with it until you find a way to be sensitive in a very open and easy, simple way. So that's your investigation you have to do. That's one thing. And the second thing is, I think it's really helpful for you to become a really good, almost like an expert at relaxing. Get really good at relaxing. Make it your specialty.
How do I do that?
Yeah. That's for you to find out.
What is Zen, and how does it relate to Buddhism and mindfulness?
Well, we're not a Zen school here. We're in a Zen center, so it's not really our place to talk about Zen. You should go to the Zen people and ask them what it is. and often, if you ask them, you get an enigmatic answer. So maybe that's why you came here. But Zen is a form of Buddhism. That the word Zen is a Japanese word, so it's a kind of Buddhism, a form of Buddhism that lives in Japan. In China, it's called Chan. And there's many different schools of Zen, different teachings of Zen. Just as there's many different schools of this, many different teachings of this particular Theravada or Vipassana practice that we're doing here. And some of the ways of doing this mindfulness practice and some of the ways of doing Zen are very similar, and some are very different from each other. And so you'll find some Zen teachers who will teach almost the same way that we teach here, and you'll find some Zen teachers are very, very different. The different schools of Zen, different teachings of Zen are so diverse, it's hard to give you a single answer. Though that's what Zen teachers do, is they'll give you one answer, if you're that lucky. Ed Brown is a wonderful Zen teacher from San Francisco Zen Center, and he did a fair amount of Vipassana practice, and he did in the late 80s he did a 3-month retreat, Vipassana retreat, after doing over 20 years of Zen practice. And he described the difference between practicing Zen and practicing Vipassana, this mindfulness. And he said, Zen is like going into the kitchen to bake a cake without the recipe. And Vipassana is like going into the kitchen with the recipe. Now, most people who don't know how to bake, if you don't have the recipe, it's not going to work very well. But if you know how to bake, or you're a culinary genius, you might actually make a better cake than if you had the recipe. And so in Vipassana, we kind of lay out the territory much more thoroughly than Zen. We explain how the mind works and the stages of practice and all the different challenges. And Vipassana comes from a school of Buddhism or a time in Buddhism it was much more psychological. Whereas in China and Japan, Buddhism lost its psychological roots that it had in India. And so there's not a lot of psychological understanding of how the mind works in Zen, the details of it. So, but in our tradition we have much more, so there's much more explanation of how all this works. And for most people, having the explanation and have the map laid out and understood well is very helpful for this process. So then to end, another way of continuing, one way to continue with this intro class, if you want to continue and get support for it, for the next 5 or 6 weeks here at IMC, we have what's called the Beginner's Practice Group. I think that's what it's called, right? And so some of the senior practitioners, two of them, who teach here at IMC, will come and be here for these 5 or 6 weeks. And it's kind of meant as a continuation of this intro class. And it's more relaxed than this, I suppose. So there's more give and take, more discussion. There's more, a little bit of teaching, there's meditation. And so it's really meant here to support you and give you a place to talk about your questions, your experience in meditation, and have some experienced practitioners share their perspective on all that. It usually is a lot smaller people, a fewer group of people, so it's more intimate that way. It's nice. So that's the one way to continue. Another way is you're always welcome to come to IMC anytime. Hopefully by now you've understood that we're intentionally somewhat casual here, very open. We don't charge for anything. Anybody can come. And when we're open, please come, anyone to come. So anything we do here, you're welcome to come. We have no membership here. So that means that anybody who wants to be a member is a member. So it's those people who would never want to be a member of a place like this, that's okay, you can't. But the idea is, if this is a useful place, we have a schedule, please come. We have a schedule throughout the week of meditations and teachings of a variety of different kinds. And it's really useful to meditate with other people. And so if you don't want to meditate here, it doesn't work to come here, you can find some place in your community where there's a meditation group that sits and meditates, or there's a lot of meditation now around, but also you can go sit with the Quakers. Sunday morning, they don't mind you sitting there quietly. They sit beautifully together. A lot of this, the schedule of all our different events are found in our newsletter. So if you didn't pick one up, there's a newsletter, variety of places around. So thank you very much for your interest and your engagement here. I hope it's been useful. And please feel free to come back anytime you want. And if you have any further questions now, you're welcome to come up here, and I'll be here to answer your questions. Many thanks. Thank you.